Midstream.
Dr. Bathina, an honor to be at your presence, and thank you for being with us to discuss pressing issues in Syria.
Thank you very much, Marwa, for coming to Damascus. It's a pleasure having you.
Our honor. Mm-hmm. Dr. Bathina, I want us to begin with the ever-complicated game of geopolitics that Syria has a great and big role in it ever since the dawn of history, but specifically in the past two decades. The Western and regional regimes are acting as if Syria is just post-war, and they're trying to find some sort of new ways to maneuver politically with Syria, especially with the on-stage now war between Russia and Ukraine being center stage at the moment. And the biggest issue that Syria is still facing with the four most challenging and pressing issues is the occupation of the U.S. Forces in the eastern part of the Euphrates. You have the occupation of the Turks in the north, occupation of the Israelis in the Golan area, in the Golan Heights, and their aggression, continuous aggression. And also, we have remnants of Daesh in certain areas, which are, by the way, in areas where the U.S. is still in Syria. But now, in what stage would you say Syria is right now, considering all these pressing challenges we just mentioned?
First, when the war started on Syria, there were only the Takfiri terrorists who are launching this war in all parts of Syria. Only when the Syrian Arab Army with its alliances with Hezbollah, with Russia, with Iran, were able to defeat these terrorists in most areas in Syria, those who were leading the war by proxy, exactly the parties you named, the U.S., Israel, Turkey, jumped into the ground and came in order to continue the mission of the terrorists whose mission was to destroy Syria, to destroy its identity, to destroy its institutions. And therefore, and as you mentioned also, it is paradoxical that Daesh, that the U.S. claims to be fighting, is there in the neighborhood, in the areas, in the domain where the U.S. Steals our oil and our wheat and the resources of the Syrian people. Therefore, we are at another stage, really, of fighting against occupation. So I see these four occupations you mentioned as another side of the coin of the terrorist war that was launched in Syria. And their mission is to continue trying to divide Syria, trying to subjugate the Syrian people, trying to strangle the Syrian people by stealing its resources, by enforcing these extremely horrible unilateral measures that are unknown in humanity, that are against all human and international law. But as the Syrian people defeated the terrorists, they are going to defeat all these occupations, and Syria will be back united. Syria is 10,000 years old. This city, Damascus, is the eldest continuously inhabited capital in the world. The question why? Because its people will always come out from the rubble and rebuild it. And the aggressors are always defeated. And those who occupy parts of our land will be defeated.
Well, it does not take two to realize that when something positive tries to happen in the region, you always have the United States of America trying and attempting to break that positive thing, like, for example, breaking the isolation of Syria. It wouldn't allow it, especially which would put Syria back on the regional scene heavily. Maybe by ensuring its military presence, pressing that they're there to help certain groups. But there's a certain rapprochement that's being spoken about in the media between Syria and Turkey, which is one of the biggest players in the global war against Syria. But when we talk about a rapprochement, we need to talk about trust. Where do you think Syria is on the ladder of trust with Turkey at the moment?
Well, I would like to draw your attention, Marwa, to the fact that we have 830 kilometers borders with Turkey. And if we didn't have these borders, those mercenaries from all over the world would not have been able to come to Syria. What I mean is that Turkey was the gateway for all the terrorists from all over the world to come to Syria. And Turkey was a major player in this terrorist war that was launched on Syria. And of course, it ended up by occupying parts of our land when the terrorists could not do the job that it wanted them to do. Therefore, what we hear in the media, for us, it doesn't mean much really, because there is no real initiative on the ground. There is no real talk on the ground. I mean, countries do not start talking through media. Those who occupy our lands have to withdraw first, have to show goodwill that they don't have really the intent to occupy our land for a long period, and that they are ready to withdraw, and that they start withdrawing. At least they honor the agreements they made. Erdogan signed with the President Putin. He didn't honor the agreement he signed to withdraw and to let the M4 be free from Latakia to Aleppo. He didn't honor any of the agreements he did. And therefore, they are bubbling in the media. And as you notice, Syria did not say anything because it doesn't mean much to us. It's not serious unless we see serious steps towards this. Trust you build with somebody who's trustworthy, whose history shows that he is trustworthy, but he has to prove on the ground with action, as the Americans say, actions speak louder than words. So all what we hear is words. We need to see actions.
Well, this brings us to discuss the relationship of Syria with its allies this time, and that stood in support of Syria's territorial integrity and Syria's sovereignty against all that had happened. And one of the main allies of Syria is the Russian Federation. It helped fight terrorism and Western neocolonialism, but it's always found in pan-Arab media after every aggression that Syria is faced from the Israeli entity. We see that the media focuses on Russia, our pan-Arab media focuses on Russia negatively. And they say this because they say that because of Russia removing the S-300, this is a permissive move for the Israelis to attack Damascus. Therefore, they hold a similar responsibility. And I know that you might disagree with this, but how would you explain the sideline behavior of Syria's main ally at a time when Israel does not miss a chance to try and break Syria militarily and economically?
Well, let me first comment in your sentence, pan-Arab media. Unfortunately, most of this pan-Arab media does not represent Arab ambitions and Arab rights and does not even reflect the truth about the Arabs. The second part of it is that Russia, as an ally, took the first double veto with China against Western intended aggression towards Syria on 4th of October 2011. Since that time, Russia has taken 17 vetoes against intended Western aggression towards Syria, and China joined Russia in 10 of these vetoes. So this is an ally that you can't trust. Mm-hmm. And then in 2015, as you know, Russia came to the ground with advisors, with Air Force help to the Syrian army to help the Syrian army in fighting terrorism. But all this, if you want, media war against Russia in Syria is to strengthen the enemy, really, and to try and make the people feel that Russia is not trustworthy, that we should not trust Russia. Russia today is fighting a war on behalf of humanity, really, because the war in the Ukraine is, in its truth, is a war between a Western hegemony and between the world that aspires to have its own independent decision and its own integrity. And therefore, Russia, of course, has its own geopolitical needs. And as allies, we understand each other and we agree with each other on any steps. But they did not mention that Russia and the Russian Air Forces and the Syrian Air Forces are leading attacks against terrorists in the northeast and the northwest of Syria. They didn't mention the effort Russia is making in order to prevent U.S. allies from partitioning Syria. They don't mention the positive side. We, as Syria, have a trustworthy ally in Russia. Every step, every move is agreed by both, both of us, and there's no problem at all. And just imagine that Syria without allies in the region, or Russia without allies. We need to really solidify our alliance. And I was talking to you off air that the strength of the West is that they get their alliances together, even to do wars and to do wrong things. So we should do our alliances together and strengthen them to do good things, to keep our identity, to keep our independence, to keep our integrity. All the media that tries to plant doubts, either against Russia or against Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many in the Arab media now, they say the problem is not Israel, it's Iran.
Definitely, and this is where I want to end off with the allies of Syria here, because it's no secret that Iran and Hezbollah played a great role alongside the Syrian Arab Army in preventing the Takfiri terrorism from Syria and eliminating also from Iraq and Lebanon. But they are also being blamed in the Western mainstream media and Israeli media as well, as they being the reason that Israel is bringing out its weapons and bombing Syria. Have these allies become some sort of a burden for Syria because they are here to help, because that's why Israel is bombing?
No, not at all. The only burden in the region is the Zionist enemy. That is the only burden in the region. As if Israel wasn't an aggressor before this war, as if Israel wasn't an aggressor before we strengthen our relation with Iran and before Hezbollah and Iran come to help Syria. Of course they will criticize, because this is against their agenda. The more we get together, the more angry they will feel. Now, I think the reason why the Zionist enemy and Western allies as well are very careful or very anxious about what's happening in the region is the plan to do a railway between Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. This, for them, is a great threat. They say because it carries arms to Hezbollah. It's not because of that. Because it's going to make the region flourishing region, because it's going to do great service to the people of the region. We have to agree that the ultimate aim of all these wars against us is to prevent us from developing, from prospering, from becoming a major player in the region. That is their aim. And therefore, really, we have to learn that whatever they say, you know, we have to interpret it, analyze it, edit it, and refuse most of it.
Well, that concludes our first segment, but brings us with a great push to our second segment of the show to talk about most pressuring issues happening right here inside Syria, where the Syrian civilians are feeling the most of it, which is the economic hardships, because the calamity to the Syrian economy for over 10 years of Takfiri terrorism, Western illegal, unilateral, punitive measures, they cannot be underestimated and they can be felt by the public. I mean, the heavy combat in Syria is probably over, the heavy bombardment campaigns. But the situation, it's becoming worse by the day economically, especially with the U.S. Caesars Act of 2019, the civilian, so-called Syrian Civilian Protection Act of 2019, and the U.S. looting more than $100 billion of Syrian oil and Syrian resources, where they are occupying land inside of Syria. And there might be some victories still going on the battlefield, and everyone recognizes them, but it's not really tangible to the citizens. but rather the losses are. In your views, how can Syria really survive this painful economic hardship?
Well, before answering this question, let me say something. Yeah. Yesterday, I was attending a lecture by Talal Abu Ghadale at Damascus University, and he said he was on the board of World Trade, International World Trade, and an important paragraph in that is that no country in the world has the right to impose sanction on any other country unilaterally without the approval either of the UN or the World Trade or without the approval of a body, an international body. And therefore, what the US called Syrian Protection Act, it is actually a criminal act. It's not a protection act. It's a criminal act against the Syrian people. And I see in it a continuation of the terrorist war against Syria because they failed to make Syria succumb, as you said in your introduction. So they turned now first to occupying the land directly, to robbing our resources. And I don't know how any country can claim to be leading in the world and yet under daylight steals the resources of another people. I mean, this is moral bankruptcy for any country. And so they turned to economic sanctions, to what is called Caesar's Act, in order to strangle the Syrian people. Of course, this is accompanied with the media you mentioned, whether pan-Arab media or Israeli media or Western media, against Russia, against Iran, against Syria, against the steadfastness, in order to make the Syrian people give up and say, okay, we can't do anything. But if they read history, they know that this is not the Syrian people who are going to do that. The Syrian people are going to soldier on with finding new ways of survival. Yesterday, our President Bashar al-Assad reopened the Center for Excellence in Homs. This was first opened in 2009. 2011, the terrorists destroyed it. That was one of the first targets that proves that they don't want us to be excellent, to be achievers. They want us to be followers of what they want us to do. Mm-hmm. Syria was able first to make this center carry on in its teaching in Latakia, in Damascus, everywhere, and now to rebuild this center. And yesterday, students went back to the center. Farmers went back to their lands. They are sowing, they are reaping, they are producing. This huge problem is an opportunity for Syria to be totally self-reliant in everything it wants. And the Syrian people are so creative and so determined and so rooted that no one will be able to uproot them.
Mm-hmm. Does that simply mean that with Syria mending its ties with certain Arab states that were against Syria at one point but now seem to have taken a U-turn, does that new relationship mean they might be willing to fund improvements in economics and development, social development, economic development inside Syria?
Well, that is a political decision, and I don't know whether it's a totally political decision or whether it has to do with with those parties who convinced them at the beginning to finance the war. You saw foreign ministers on TV saying that they put $37 billion to finance the war on Syria. So if they now don't, the war doesn't help Syria, it is, for me, understandable because they didn't want Syria to survive anyway.
But they did open new doors of communication with Syria, for example, like the UAE.
There are new doors, but they haven't yet reached the point of becoming essential for rebuilding in Syria. Because, as I said, you know, we don't know who can and who cannot due to political circumstances and to political decision. Syria is open, and Syria doesn't have a resentment. You know, even internally, President Bashar al-Assad started a reconciliation process many years ago, and it have got its fruition, really, in the country. And therefore, we look to the future. We are not people who work on resentment and who look into the past. What I mean is that, of course, after wars, countries will go back, will start relations, but on certain basis, on the basis of integrity, of dignity, and with full respect to those who sacrifice their lives in order to protect the independent decision of the country. Mm-hmm. That's most important.
And when you say that Syrians do not hold a grudge and do not resent, it's basically because of the bringing up. And bringing up means the role of women in the Syrian society. I mean, the global war in Syria had devastating impact on women. It also had shifted their roles in the workforce inside of Syria. But consequently, women are becoming increasingly influential in the public space in Syria and shaping Syria's future. I want to read an excerpt from your book, which I would love for you to sign for me when we finish our interview. But you say, I believe it is time Arab women learned...
this book.
Yes, I will say exactly the title of the book, which is Both Right and Left-Handed by Dr. Buthaina Shaban. It's about stories of Arab women in our region. And in this book, you practically say that I believe it is time Arab women learned not to fight men's battles while losing out themselves. I think our priority as women should be to help spread a feminist consciousness in every domain and across all categories, social categories, in order to be prepared for these struggles to come. You wrote this in the Both Right and Left-Handed in 1988.
Yeah.
Were Syrian women ready for the tsunami wave that struck in 2011, as it still has shock waves and ripples affecting the ability to create maybe even new unthinkable challenges for these women?
I don't think anybody was ready for this tsunami. I think the whole so-called Arab Spring, which is an Arab disaster, took everybody by surprise. But we quickly adapted to the situation and started to deal with it. And I really believe at times of crisis, as at other times, peaceful times, women have an extremely fundamental role to play. And in this war, as you said, women are the ones who actually bring up their children, are the ones who plant in their heads the importance of the country, the sacrifice for the country. I mean, if you see the Syrian woman whose sons would go to fight terrorists and that they would receive their bodies, first son and second son, and they would say, this is, you know, an honor for us because it is for the sake of the country. I mean, it takes really great bravery for a mother and great also belief, great faith in the country to be able to say that. Now, I wrote this book in the aftermath of the liberation also of Algeria. I made many interviews with Algerian women. And Algerian women said that we were fighting the political war, but without paying attention to our rights. And when the war was over, we did not get our rights. And what I meant is that during the war, when women are sacrificing and women are playing an important role in fighting this war, they should also think of their rights. The whole, not only women, men also should think of radicalizing the society, not just winning the war on the ground in the battlefield, but winning the social war, winning the economic war, winning the human war, winning the educational war. Therefore, that's what I mean, and I believe in that, really. I mean, I was a feminist, I'm still a feminist, but now I believe that I'm capable to fight not only for women, not only for Arab women and men, but for human being in general, everywhere. And therefore, there are basic rules that should apply that would make everybody happier. But I don't believe in Western feminism.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shaban, for your time and for your contribution to our show.
Thank you very much, Marwa, and all the power to you.
Thank you.
I think the world needs you, not only Arab women. The world needs your voice.
I'm humbled by your words. Thank you very much.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The recent attacks by Zionist settlers against Palestinians are an attempt to inflame the situation in the occupied territories to the benefit of party campaigns ahead of the Zionist regime's next month's election. According to reports, these attacks have been perpetrated by a large number of settlers, including women and children. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Middle East Eye, there have been more than 100 attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank over the last 10 days, according to local media. The Israeli regime newspaper Haaretz recently said that most of the attacks it had documented had taken place in the northern West Bank, especially in the town of Hawara in Nablus Governorate. Last week, dozens of settlers attacked Palestinian property and vehicles in the Hawara area. Witnesses told Middle East Eye that masked settlers threw rocks at Palestinian vehicles near the town, as well as setting vehicles and olive trees on fire. Abdullah Odeh, who owns a local amusement park in Hawara, said residents had almost been successful in repelling the settlers when a group of Israeli troops arrived. The settlers were retreating, but when they saw the soldiers, they came back in force and started to get closer, breaking everything in their path, Odeh said, adding, "The soldiers did not push them back. Instead, they started to attack us and shoot towards us." Footage from Odeh's security cameras reviewed by Middle East Eye corroborates his history. He says, "While the soldiers were pushing us back and attacking us, the settlers started to set fire to one of our vans that was parked higher up on the hill, while another group of them came and started to set fire to one of our lorries. Armed with stones, sticks, and guns, another group of settlers began throwing rocks at passing cars and smashing up shops along the town's main road. Recently, two activists were injured by Zionist settlers armed with stones and clubs while helping Palestinians harvest olives in the village of Kesan, south of Beit Lahm. Tali Katzir, an activist who was at the scene, told Haaretz, "About 20 settlers arrived and started attacking the harvest volunteers." Katzir said Hagar Gefan, a 70-year-old human rights activist, was among those injured. Katzir said she suffers from broken ribs and bruises all over her body. Knesset lawmakers Aida Tuma Silman and Ofer Kassit from Hadas Tatal condemned the attack and called for those behind it to be held responsible. "This horrific attack is a direct result of the criminal silence from Prime Minister Yair Lapid, Benny Gantz, and Public Security Minister Omer Bar-Lev in the face of settler terrorism," Tuma Suleiman said. Haaretz said that while Israeli Chief of Staff Aviv Kochavi had been quick to condemn attacks by settlers on Israeli soldiers, no such criticism had been made by the army over attacks against Palestinians. An Israeli troop from an illegal West Bank settlement near Nablus was arrested on suspicion of participating in a settler attack on an Israeli regime unit earlier in the day. Recently, a group of settlers threw rocks at passing Palestinian vehicles in Hawara before attacking Zionist regime troops dispatched to the area with pepper gas. A security source told a newspaper that, contrary to claims by senior security officials, that attacks on Palestinians were being carried out by an out-of-control handful of settlers, well known to the security establishment, they were in fact being perpetrated by a large number of settlers, including women and children. The source added that attacks by settlers were an attempt to inflame the situation in the occupied territories to the benefit of party campaigns ahead of the Zionist regime's next month's election. Palestinian Wafa News Agency also reported the daily Israeli newspaper Haaretz revealed that more than 100 attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians have been documented in different areas of the West Bank in the last 10 days. The newspaper stated that in the last 10 days, settlers have attacked Palestinians more than 100 times, and that most of these attacks took place in northern West Bank, especially in the town of Hawara in Nablus. It said that these settlers' violence was not addressed by the Zionist regime's army, who was quick to condemn the settlers' pepper spray attack against the troops. The newspaper denied claims by the Zionist regime army that those who carry out attacks against Palestinians are a minority, stating that this is not true because there are large numbers of settlers who take part in the attacks against Palestinians. In this regard, Wafa correspondents reported that the Zionist regime occupation army did not arrest or investigate settlers who attack on a daily basis the Palestinian citizens and their property, but rather guards the aggressor, the settler, and provides them with protection.
Bazaar.
Many people have ideas. However, those who turn their ideas into reality are the ones who search for ways to make their ideas happen. More often than not, this occurs by joining knowledge with method. Knowledge brings competitive advantages and generates sustainable market leadership. Its tools are creativity and innovation, which are all intangible human talents. Never more than now has knowledge been so critical and significant in production and the shift towards a knowledge-based economy. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Alireza Ikhtiyarzadeh, and this week we are going to explore the central role science and technology parks play in complementing the knowledge-based production ecosystem. We wanted to see how the government is shifting towards a knowledge-based economy, and plus we wanted to understand why tech parks are so critical to industry development and the national economy. So let's get started. To better understand the country's knowledge-based ecosystem, we visited an event at Semnan Science and Technology Park where we could get some answers. Science and technology parks are where startups and innovative teams can operate in one geographical location. These areas provide diverse services and facilities to companies that fit the criteria. We were able to catch up with a couple companies that operate out of this park. One of these companies specializes in producing advanced machines used in mining. This company is one of only a handful that has managed to indigenize these previously imported products. Events like the one we visited helped braid together and link companies, investors, and infrastructures with the necessary resources to complete projects. These components all make up the various parts of the knowledge-based ecosystem. But we also wanted to know how science and tech parks operate and why they are attractive to businesses. One of the advantages of these parks is that it's a space where crucial resources are offered. These places are a focal point for serving knowledge-based companies producing advanced, specialized products needed in the domestic market. Science and technology parks also serve as a launching pad toward the international arena. We spoke with a park official who helped shed more light on this issue.
There are four scenarios of which foreign companies could have the opportunity to reside in Semnan Science and Technology Park. Well, the first scenario will be the execution of soft lending programs between the two countries, which gives the foreign companies an opportunity to get familiar with the host country's market. Well, the second scenario will be holding joint events, including joint startup events, fairs and similar events which could help them get familiar with each other. And the other scenario, or the third way that a company could have the chance to come to our park, will be to find and carry out joint projects with our companies, and finally sharing the interests. The fourth scenario will be holding joint innovation tours, which gives them, which gives the companies an opportunity to get familiar with how you know innovation ideas are being implemented in other countries.
These parks are essential in filling a gap in the tech innovation ecosystem, providing monetary resources and attracting investments. These establishments also join investors with particular companies and projects. They offer numerous unique services such as facilitating visa processes, offering financial assistance such as soft loans, or even special incentives under free trade zones like tax exemptions. And it doesn't stop there. This park offers so much more to investors.
The other solution, or the other way that could attract foreign investors, will be to define BOT models, which means they have to introduce projects and within the framework of our protocols. And once it has been approved, They can operate the project for a while. This includes mainly long-term projects, particularly, and I shall have to tell you, that Semnon Science and Technology Park is very interested in projects in the fields of artificial intelligence, IT, ICT, IoT, and virtual reality. And we could help these companies. And once they have, once they build it and then operate it, they could transfer it to our park.
Most tech parks are active in the international sphere and collaborate with other domestic tech parks. Furthermore, these areas function as export hubs. Therefore, one of their main activities is boosting and supplying domestic products to this end.
Semnon Science and Technology Park has been very active in international arena, and our president, Dr. Nazari, has put a great focus in this part. And for information, I have to tell you that we have held two prestigious international events at our park. One in our park, last year we did it in March, I think, with the presence of some great companies, a Turkish delegation, some companies from Turkey. And before that, we held a joint event with Paris Technology Park, which was technology investment meeting, which we had brought another Turkish delegation to that event. And it was one of the first collaborations between science and technology parks of Iran with Paris Technology Park in such a big international event.
Over the years, the government has placed special attention on knowledge-based companies while implementing new approaches to support tech parks and their businesses. Some of these initiatives aim to remove obstacles along the path of development of these companies. Other activities involve giving resources to executive branches to further develop the ecosystem of innovation and technology nationwide. Along these lines, the Vice Presidency for Science and Technology has implemented a series of activities. This includes investing some $1.4 billion towards financial services. The government has also created a strategic technology development headquarters. It is tasked with implementing 400,000 tech projects and 150 commercialization projects. But that's not all. The government has also established 65 innovation centers and dozens more accelerators to support the developing entrepreneurship ecosystem. Currently, there are well over 7,000 knowledge-based companies scattered across the nation. These enterprises offer services and products in numerous industries. Many are active in biotech, computer software, agriculture, food, chemical tech, aircraft maintenance, steel, gas, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals, just to name a few. According to government figures, the knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. Moreover, the share of knowledge firms in the country's GDP in 2019 exceeded $34 billion and witnessed a 450% growth since then. That's all according to the Vice President for Science and Technology. All right, now it's time for me to take a little break here and hand it over to my good friend out in the field who's prepared a report for us.
In ancient Iran, felt was already used in the production of numerous kinds of clothing, bed clothes, floor carpets, and different kinds of sacks. In fact, the Iranian world may have been an important center for the development of felt technology. In the modern world today, felt or namat has found its way to industries of all kinds in various forms.
You just can't imagine how crowded this place is. Whenever I want to talk on the phone, I have to find a sign-up place to be able to talk to you. It's really crazy. God, in today's chaotic society, stress is an issue that many of us suffer from every day. But what matters most is trying to find distress sources and try to find effective solutions. For this reason, today I'm here to tell you that I finally found a startup, a new innovative company that has finally found a solution to this disastrous problem. I won't tell you any further. Let's just go and check it out.
Felt, or so-called Namat, is the acoustic solution for rowdy places to absorb and decrease undesirable noises. The aim is to provide sound serenity and to improve physical, mental, and psychological health. Namat Studio's scope of work is based on designing and manufacturing products. Recently, it has also played a significant role in different projects like some innovation centers in Asia and Africa. This company has focused on designing and building acoustic products. Generally in Iran, there is no specific competitor in this field. However, there are some groups in America and Northern Europe that are engaged with Felt.
If I want to tell you about a history about how our company established, it goes back to 3 years ago when Diva was chosen to renovate the innovation factory of Iran, that was the biggest one in the time. And the designer tried to make the offices and they tried to design a place that the people be comfortable, have a good place to work. That's why we understand that we have some advantages and disadvantages. One of these disadvantages is about the sound pollution that we had in the this area, that places were noisy and the employees didn't like that. That's why we try to use special materials for control this sound pollution. And we reached the felt material and we try to use this material.
Designing acoustic and movable working stations with the aim of recycling old products and reuse them in different functions. What is worth noticing about this business is the fact that the problem-solution method is based upon three WH questions: why, how, and what. Why is to define the problem, how is the process towards the solution, and what is the final product and prototype. These acoustic solutions were combined with architecture in various parts of the space and played the role in sound insulation and creating a silent space.
All right, now I want to walk you through some of the major products that are made of felt. The first piece we have here is an artwork that is made of wool felt that acts as a sound-absorbing material, not only as an aesthetic material that you can put it in your home place, but also as a sound-absorbing material. There is the phone booth. If I get inside, I can feel the private space and how the atmosphere really changes. It improves the acoustic vibes and reduces the reverberation when I get inside. And there's this whole thing, we call it desk divider. It's actually one of the main products in this company. People and employees put it in their on their desk to divide their own workplace with the person right next to them.
We have three different kind of material that we use on our works that absorb undesirable sounds, which are wool panels, or the other name is felt, and in Persian we say namat, and thermofelt and carpet. And the felt are in two kind of industrial felt and the natural felt. Natural felt is made by wools, and industrial material is made by a process by the battles and pet materials. They have different color patterns and thicknesses. The thicknesses are from 3 millimeter to 50 millimeter. And about the thermofelt, we have this material that we can use for more absorption. It has three kind of material with polyester, jeans, and heavy traffic, and it's very good for absorbing. And the last one is the carpet that is heavy traffic that we use in heavy traffic places such as the offices, and it can be cleaned very easy by the vacuum cleaner.
As I mentioned earlier, this idea was created based on the concept of recreating, recycling, and revitalizing the surrounding substances and generalizing this idea to the upcoming products with different potentials. Such small-scale products are intended to improve the mental and physical health of users. And finally, creating a comfortable, inviting atmosphere.
Almost everything here is made of felt. Based on environmental psychology, the linear lighting has been created in a way to provide maximum visual and acoustic comfort in the workplace, especially a co-working space like this. This company, Namad Startup, has been trying to promote sustainability and also take steps towards industrialization. Among all the products here, there were so many things, but I decided to choose this felt laptop case to carry my laptop with me wherever I go. So as you could see, it's not about the ideas, it's about making the ideas happen.
There is so much more that can be said about the country's knowledge-based production and activities, so before we go, let's look at a couple of developments in this area. Most of us are familiar with vitamin supplements. However, some vitamins need to be injected, which can be a hassle. Now, a knowledge-based company has produced an oral form of one of these vitamins, saving many of us from the pain of sticking needles. This pharmaceutical company has produced the first oral form of a vitamin B complex that was typically only found in an injectable form. This company also operates out of Pardis Science and Technology Park. It is also one of the first and largest knowledge-based companies. It might be interesting to know that this company mainly produces raw materials such as probiotic products needed in the pharma industry. Such productions have saved the country millions on imports so far. Knowledge-based productions are driven by scientific discoveries, and Iranian scientists produce roughly 2% of the world's scientific articles. That's according to the Minister of Science, Research and Technology. Mohammad Ali Zulfigol says Iran, on average, registers around 70,000 scientific articles in international journals each year. He says Iran is now globally ranked 15th for the number of scientific papers it produces. Zulfigol noted the quality ranking of Iranian articles in the top 10 fields like technology and engineering. The minister highlighted that the nation ranks 5th in nanotechnology publications as well. The official further added that those publishing academic articles also work in knowledge-based companies, helping produce quality products in the competitive field. And with that, we come to the end of this segment. You can contact us with your thoughts and comments via email. And don't forget, you can also send us topics you're interested in. Thank you for tuning in and join us next week, same time, for another edition of Bazaar. It's bye for now. Until then.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
British Prime Minister Liz Truss finally resigned, as experts had predicted her collapse days and even weeks before. Liz Truss's legacy for Britain was a tanking pound, soaring inflation, and a seemingly inevitably recession. World media websites have analyzed this issue and the economic challenges that face Britain. Stay tuned for the third part, please. Guardian wrote, Liz Truss ignored the stark warnings from economists sympathetic to her growth strategy that the mini-budget that ultimately led to her downfall risked triggering a financial markets meltdown. The Guardian has learned. Truss announced her resignation recently after just 44 days in Downing Street after a package of tax cuts and spending increases on September 23rd rattled the markets, prompted a run on pension funds, and sent the cost of mortgages spiraling. But days before the start of her premiership, she was told by The Economist, Gerard Lyons and Julian Jessop, that the markets were highly nervous and that she could face a crash if her policy changes were not handled with care. Lyons and Jessop, who were supportive of Truss' growth agenda, prepared a paper for a meeting at Chevening, the country residence of Foreign Secretary as Truss was 2 days before she was announced as Boris Johnson's successor on September 5th. Also in attendance were Kwasi Kwarteng, who would be Truss's chancellor, Matteo Sinclair, Truss's economic policy advisor, and a third economist, Andrew Lilico. The paper supported the idea that the new government needed to hit the ground running, but repeatedly stressed the need to keep the financial markets one side. predicting the chaos that was to follow Corting's £45 billion of unfunded tax cuts announced in his September 23rd mini-budget, it said, "The markets are nervous about the UK and about the policy options. If immediate economic policy announcements